Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky and disturbing children's books, films and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host Adam Wybrow, and today we're joined by special guest Stuart Young to talk about The Mouse and His Child by Russell Hoban and the associated film. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Welcome to Still Scared Pod. I'm Ren Wednesday. My co-host is Adam Wybrow, and our special guest is Stuart Young, who is a senior producer at Fail Better Games and a friend of Adam's from the past. And we've come here today to talk about The Mouse and His Child by Russell Hoban. Both in a book and film version. And this was a suggestion from Stu, who presumably watched it as a kid or encountered
it
in some way.
Hi, it's Stu, by the
Hello.
Way. I've never watched the film. I'm quite intrigued. Yeah, but no, I've only read the book. I read the book as a child, an older child. My mum only gave it to me when I was about 10 or 11, which I think is probably quite wise.
So is it something that your mum had read when she was young?
I think she'd read it as an adult, because if you think about it, it was published in 1967.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she'd have definitely been like a teenager when it came out at a minimum. So I think she probably read the book as an adult.
And this is, yeah, Russell Hoban, who I only knew for Ridley Walker, which is his kind of post-apocalyptic novel from 1980, which is kind of written in this like imagined dialect that's developed in England kind of 2000 years after a nuclear war. So I didn't really know what to expect from a children's book by him.
Basically the same thing. I mean, not to be reductive, but yeah, it's quite similar, a sort of journey, you know, kind of picaresque, sort of wandering book, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
There's a fair amount of wandering, but also there's quite a lot where they don't get to wander, right? I think for a book about two clockwork creatures that are set on a journey as tramps and get wound up to go or wandering from one place to another, there's a lot of times where they're stopped in their tracks and have to, because they aren't self-winding and their mission is to try to become self-winding. So there's long sections where they get stuck, right? And they can't move forward. So it's as much like a journey through time and stillness as it is forward movement, which I thought was really interesting for, like, you know, most kind of, whether it's a road trip movie or, say, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn or other children's books that take place from one place to another, normally the character will get to move on their journey when they want. Whereas with The Mouse and His Child, because they're both clockwork, they don't get to move forwards when they want. They're completely at the whim of nature and beholden to other creatures, which is really interesting.
Yeah, that's very true. It does sort of compare with Ridley Walker differently there, because, of course, you know, that takes place in about a couple of weeks, I think. I think there's one major time shift in it. Whereas this, one of the things I did notice, you know, like you, was that there are these sort of like huge time shifts where they just get stuck.
Yeah.
And they just have to, you know, live with their sort of locked in syndrome, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's what I would have found most disturbing myself as a kid.
Same. I mean, it's kind of like the body horror of it, yeah. And it really is quite like something like The Diving Bell and the Butterfly or something like that, where it's like just kind of gives you an insight into just how terrible it would be not to have any agency.
Yeah, I think if we come back to the horror of it, and I'll just give a little introduction to the story, just to situate people. So the mouse and his child are a joined pair of wind-up toys. The father swings the child in his arms, and they dance, and they sort of attain consciousness in a toy shop with this ornate doll's house. So there's a tin seal with a ball on her nose and a plush wind-up elephant. He sings a lullaby to the mouse child when he cries. And they're sold and placed under a Christmas tree, and then dance until they're broken by a family cat, then rescued from the dustbin, repaired by a tramp who sets them down on the side of the road and tells them, be tramps. They're then intercepted by Manny Rat, who's a kind of dubious fellow who commands an army of wind-ups who he's repaired. He sends them on a mission with one of his rat lackeys to commandeer Treacle Brittle, but the lackey botches it, gets eaten by a badger, and the mouse and his child escape. And Manny Rat sort of takes this as a personal affront, and from then on there's this kind of push and pull where the child's determined to find the seal and the elephant so they can be a family. The mouse father's determined to become self-winding so he's not dependent on being wound up, and the two of them are pursued by Manny Rat, who's determined to smash them to pieces. It's essentially the setup. I think we can go back to the horror of it, because I think that's that does come in quite early with the kind of the condition of being a wind-up toy and what that means, I guess.
Well, I think you also immediately have this contrast set up, and I think sometimes this feels very much like a Victorian children's book, and sometimes it feels like it's drawing from much older traditions, like some kind of early modern allegory. And I guess that's just because Victorian kids books drew on older traditions themselves, but it starts out with this very Victorian image of a toy shop, everything brass and gleaming and shining, and then the figure of a homeless man, this tramp, outside looking in, the kind of sort of tragical image you'd see on a Victorian biscuit box. So you immediately have this contrast between the kind of haves and the have-nots, and this sort of easeful life inside the doll's house, with these sort of proper little gentlemen and gentlewomen who seem disturbingly kind of mindless, because the tin toys can talk. But then the little doll inhabitants of the doll's house just talk in like newspaper mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
Which immediately is quite disturbing, because there's this real confusion of like agency. And okay, so these clockwork toys can think for themselves, but they possibly don't have free will. Like they're wind up, and they kind of go through their rituals and movements over and over again. But then these other toys who are in the doll's house, they don't seem to be able to think at all. So there's this clockwork elephant, and it says, it's on page 6 of my copy, "It was the elephant's constant delight to watch that tea party through the window. And as the hostess, she took great pride in the quality of her hospitality.
Have another cup of tea,
he said to one of the ladies.
Try a little pastry. High society scandal, plain to carry, with a possibility of pardons galore,
replied the lady.
Her papier-mâché head, being made of paste, newsprint, she always spoke in scraps of news and advertising, whatever order they came to mind.
Bucket seats,
remarked the gentleman next to her.
Power steering optional? Government forms?
And yeah, that immediately kind of freaked me out. This this idea that these dongs just kind of talk in minced up random nonsense words from newspapers.
And it makes it, in the film, it's quite nightmarish, sort of quite off the bat with these dolls spouting nonsense and the clock with a face that...
Oh, yeah.
Tells them it's midnight. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So the film, and it is worth watching. It's available on YouTube, albeit in quite diminished quality. But it's directed by Murakami Wolf and Sanrio. So that is
Of Hello Kitty fame.
Of Hello Kitty fame. Of the sticker books I give cutesy stickers to my students when they behave well fame. You have a certain cutesy design with the mouse and his child, but it's also got that, I don't know, like 70s kids animation has this specific hippy-dippy style that is like really hard to pin down, but you recognise it immediately. Like, it looks really 70s anyway. Like, you would be able to immediately tell this is a 70s animation. So it's from 1977. And the most jarring thing about it, I don't know if you feel the same, Ren, is the sound design and music is batshit.
It is arrestingly interesting.
It is wild. It is one of the weirdest like soundtracks to a kids film I've ever heard. Like, pretty much all my notes are just about the sound design of the soundtracks. It's so strange. So like, it starts off with this really awful tuneless like existential theme song sung by a child quite badly.
And then there's this big jazz influence, because Roger Calloway, who's the composer, was also a jazz pianist, so we've got all this kind of jazz stuff going on.
Yeah.
And then there's these songs that kind of narrate what's happening in this very like operatic style that are also really odd.
I'll put an excerpt to try to capture. And then when you get to the kind of sewer, junkyard where the rats live, you've got this sort of, I've written like swamp jazz, basically. Well, swamp jazz funk. It's this kind of weird Louisiana jazz. And it's pretty avant-garde and discordant. Really, really wild music in places. Worth watching, if only. I mean, there's other good aspects to it, but the sound design is really freaky.
Yeah. Stu, what when you read it as a kid, what were the bits that gave you the horrors?
I didn't know if you would particularly want to even cover this, because it's not ostensibly a horror book, but I think it's probably one of the most horrifying children's books. So like we were saying earlier, like this sort of the fact that the two mice, well, in fact, all of the wind-up toys, because there are lots of other wind-up characters like the elephant and so forth, the fact that they can't move unless somebody else winds them up, and then they can just become trapped for very long periods of time. Unable to, you know, they have consciousness and they're unable to move. That's pretty horrifying. There was a lot of it to me that was kind of almost like body horror, because there's some really sort of quite grisly sort of depictions of and descriptions of these wind-up toys being smashed up and sort of parts being put back into them, and it's never quite clear as to when consciousness sort of enters and leaves their bodies.
Yeah.
So you've got them being smashed and disassembled and then being put back together with, you know, in a kind of crap way, and they can't move properly. And it's there's some of that imagery. It's really quite horrific.
In
particular.
There was a bit that I was going to ask you to read, Adam, which is the elephant's encounter with Manny Rat on page 27 in my edition, just because I thought you could do a good Manny Rat.
Oh, okay. Yes, I think so. Is this where Manny Rat meets the elephant? Good evening, madame.
Yes.
Okay. Good evening, madame, said Manny Rat. Do we find ourselves quite worn out and thrown away? Do we lie here lonely in the wintry waste and rot? Oh, the pity of it. The elephant said nothing. Be of good cheer, said Manny Rat. Rejoice! Help is at hand. Still, the elephant preserved her silence. Surely you can speak, said Manny Rat. You have heard the striking of the town hall clock, and the hour is long past midnight.
We have not been introduced, murmured the elephant, almost inaudibly, as if she hoped to create the illusion that the words had not actually come from her.
Ah, but we shall be, said Manny Rat. We shall become, moreover, close friends and intimate associates. He tried the elephant's key, but could not turn it. The spring was tightly wound and thick with rust. What better introduction could there be, he said, than to take you apart and repair you so you can work for me? He produced a rusty beer can opener from within his robe and undid the tin clasps that held the elephant together. Nothing more to say, madame? He asked, as he pried apart the two halves of her tin body. Not so much as a how do you do? But the elephant was silent. She had fainted.
Oh, that really, really gave me the shivers.
That was an excellent Manny Rat. I think...
Thank you.
I think Manny Rat is genuinely one of the great villains. I think he's up there with like Richard III or Fagin. Fagin is the most close sort of famous villain, I think, that he resembles, right? But he's of his own. He's his own rat.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to like even like figure out sort of what makes him tick, or you know, at the end of the book. The end of the book is very interesting.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, he often doesn't seem to know himself what makes him tick. Like, as you say, a lot of the book with Manny Rat, and there are sections when you move away from the mouse and his child, and you've just got sort of Manny Rat on his possibly Pyrrhic journey to smash the mouse and his child. And there are times where he starts sort of thinking to himself, what am I doing? You know, I've been trudging across the wintry wastes for months following this clockwork mouse and child. What has happened to me? Yeah, you get these really interesting moments of kind of self-reflection. But yeah, he is my texture of the week. So shall we... I heard you've got a marimba, Stu.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I thought this was appropriate.
Excellent.
Texture of the week.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Okay, so I've got one from quite early on in the book, which is the first description of Manny Rat. And I have to say, the drawings, who, I don't know, in my edition, I think they were by Lillian Hoban, so Russell Hoban's wife at the time, who actually illustrated a plethora of children's books, more prolific actually than Russell Hoban. And yeah, I really love the illustrations in my edition. They've got a really nice kind of fine kind of skittish line work, like really sort of skitty little lines. And Manny Rat looks really horrible. So yeah. A large rat crept out of the shadows of the girders into the light of the overhead lamps, and he stood up suddenly on his hind legs before the mouse and his child. He wore a greasy scrap of silk paisley tied with a dirty string in the manner of a dressing gown, and he smelled of darkness, of stale and mouldy things, and garbage. He was there all at once, and with a look of tenure, as if he had been waiting always just beyond their field of vision, and once let in, would never go away. In the eerie blue glare he peered beadily at father and son, and his eyes, as passing headlights came and went, flashed blank and red like two round tiny ruby mirrors. His whiskers quivered as his face came closer. He bared his yellow teeth and smiled, and a paw shot out to strike the mouse and his child a rattling blow that knocked them flat. And one thing I like in the book is that you get these sort of progressive textures of Manny Rat as his dressing gown becomes more tattered as he progresses on his journey, but also the mouse and his child, who sound rather handsome at the start of the book, and slowly become corroded and eroded away, and all their fur gets...
Oh, okay, I can come in there with my texture.
Okay. Oh no, I failed to guess your texture. Really? So, Ren, I was convinced that your texture this week was going to be the frog glove.
Oh, well... I did love the frog glove.
I saw the frog, like... wiggling away inside the glove of the animation, and I was like, oh, that's got to be Ren's texture, surely.
I mean, yeah, that's an honourable mention, for sure.
Okay, so what have you gone with?
But I've gone with the description of the mouse and his child after they have been at the bottom of a pond for quite some time, and have eventually escaped. It says, "The mouse and his child lay in a puddle on the stone as the water drained out of them. They were spotted, streaked, and pitted with rust at all their joints, and the arms they stretched out to each other were naked, rusty wires. What fur remained was black with rot and green with moss and algae. Their tattered ears stood bent and crooked on their heads. Their whiskers hung in limp dejection."
And what child would want that for a Christmas present? So Stu, do you have a texture?
Yeah, weirdly, okay, so I actually wrote down as a quote, but not as a texture, "He was there all at once and with a look of tenure, as if he had been waiting always just beyond their field of vision, and once let in would never go away," which was, I think, part of the extract you read out, right?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the defining quotes of the book. I think it's so creepy. Yeah. And then the other thing that I'd highlighted and was going to be my texture was streaked and pitted with rust at all their joints, and the arms they stretched out to each other were naked, rusty wires. What fur remained was black with rot and green with moss and algae. Yeah. Which
is... I'm glad we anticipated you.
So, like, yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, strong textures. You've clearly got an eye for textures. Yeah.
But I think the last one that I really like, that's kind of like the gets to the sort of the part of the horror of it for me. You know, this idea that obviously, even though they're, you know, their bodies are these sort of mechanical bodies, it feels to me like body horror. Like it's like thinking about, you know, how terrible it would be to have something like that happen to you, and like how weird and how, you know, behind their layers of sort of plush and velveteen or whatever. Yeah. They're just wires, you know, in the same way as if you strip back one's skin, you're just bones underneath. You know, it gave me that same kind of feeling.
Yeah, particularly the naked, rusty wires. That's...
Yeah.
Mm.
I think it's also... There's that horror of not knowing where their essence resides, which is a human horror as well. Like when you try to meditate and work out where exactly your consciousness is, and you start there, oh, is it sort of between the bridge of my nose, or is it at the back of my head? And it starts feeling very weird when you try to really delve into where is the I coming from. Like I've mentioned before, I think how I really like in you're getting Henry Selick's works, so like Coraline, but also Nightmare Before Christmas, this confusion about where the consciousness is coming from. So like with Oogie Boogie in the Nightmare Before Christmas, this idea that like, is he a singular being with a kind of single consciousness, or is his consciousness like a group consciousness of all the bugs he's made out of? And then when he falls apart at the end, does that mean his consciousness splits apart? Do each of the individual bugs have like a little oogie boogie in them? Or the same as in Coraline, there's the other Mr. Babinski who's made up of rats. And again, it's like, okay, where's this selfhood coming from? And you get the sense of like the characters in this, their sense of self being quite at odds often with their external appearance. There's a lovely and strange bit, which is, I think, completely a character that's completely cut out of the film called Miss Mud. Who I really liked when the mouse and his child are at the bottom of the pond. And Miss Mud at first just seems to be a little kind of squiggly organism, basically. Says, maybe I could help you look, said a small and gentle voice. And maybe you talk to me and not eat me up. Would you, do you think, not eat me? We don't eat anybody, said the mouse child. Where are you? Here, said the voice. By your feet. I don't have anyone to talk to. It's depressing.
Who are you? Said the father.
I don't know, said the voice. I don't even know what I am. When I talk to myself, I call myself Mud. That's silly, I know, but you have to call yourself something if you've got no one else to talk to.
There was a stirring in the ooze at the mouse child's feet, and an ugly little creature rose up and leaned lightly against his leg.
What are you?
It said.
We're toy mice, said the child. Is it Miss or Mr. Mud? Please excuse my asking, but I can't tell by looking at you.
Miss,
said the little creature. She was something like a misshapen grasshopper, and was as drab and muddy as her name.
I'll be your friend if you'll be mine, she said.
Will you, do you think? I'm so unsure of everything. We'll be your friend, said the child. We're unsure too, especially about the little dogs.
I know, said Miss Mud. It's all so difficult, and of course everyone bigger than I tries to eat me. And I'm always busy eating everyone smaller, so there isn't much time to think things out.
As she spoke, she flung out what looked like an arm from her face, caught a water flea and ate it up.
It's distasteful, she said. I know it's distasteful. I've got this nasty sort of huge lip with a joint in it like an elbow, and I catch my food with it. And the odd thing is, you see, is I don't think that's how I really am. I just can't believe on this muddy thing you see crawling about in the muck. I don't feel as if I am.
And it turns out that she had dragonfly in, chrysalis or pupa.
Or maybe damselfly. But yeah. But again, when she hatches, even that moment is quite horrific. But then, you know, she does have this happy ending where she sort of flies off dragonfly.
I mean, quite a lot of the characters actually do end up delightfully with fairly happy endings. But some of the minor characters definitely don't. I don't know if that's something that disturbed you as a kid, Stu. There's very much this depiction of nature as red in tooth
and claw. The weasels,
and
for example.
You'll find that, like, minor characters are often dispatched like animals of Farthingwood style.
Yeah. it's very, very unafraid, particularly for a children's book,
yeah,
to just outright kill characters a lot. And what's interesting is that the... you know, you're talking a little bit before about the sort of sentience of the clockworks and where that sentience originates.
Mm.
The animals in the story sort of actually think of themselves as above the clockworks.
Yeah.
They don't think the clockworks are even really alive. You know, that they could regard them as like sort of robots or something like that. But the animals are also very mortal in a way that the clockworks, the clockwork creatures have some kind of... yeah, you know, level of robustness or semi-immortality if you fix them. So the animals, the flesh and blood animals, are constantly eating each other and killing each other. So I sort of actually wrote down like a list of... I won't read them all out, but I've written a list of all the terrible violence.
Oh, please do.
But it's really quite shocking. on page 30, well, on page 34, 31, we have an explicit use of the word slaves, which isn't, I suppose, violence, but, well, it is, I suppose, in a way, but nobody dies. Then on page 34, this is our sort of first, I think, real death, where Ralphie, who's kind of Manny Rat's useless sidekick, is completely killed unceremoniously by being eaten by a badger. in page 51, a very sympathetic child shrew character who's like a little drumming boy is killed by a spear through the throat, which they explicitly, you know, Russell Hoban explicitly details that it's through his throat, and that is very similar to Ridley Walker and this kind of like sort of sudden and shocking violence. There are other shrews killed during the shrew war as well. Oh, here are some lovely haunting descriptions of the dead. Their open eyes fast glazing in the moonlight. The mouse child stared beyond his father's shoulder at the astonishing stillness of the dead. This is after the aftermath of the shrew war. Then all of the shrews, even the victors, are suddenly killed by weasels. And then the weasels are both killed by an owl.
And the way that the description of the weasels being killed, it says... they nuzzled each other affectionately as they ran, and their heads were so close together that when the horned owl swooped down out of the moonlight, his talons pierced both brains at once.
Yeah. Because these weasels, you know, again, the weasels are weirdly depicted in this quite sympathetic way, where they're like a married couple, and they're like, oh, this is a good, you know, place for hunting these delicious shrews. And so the kind of like the perspective zooms up to the weasels who've just eaten all of these shrews, the shrews of whom are quite sort of, you know, very violent and warlike themselves and only killing each other. But then your sort of sympathy turns for a moment to these weasels who've just, you know, committed this shrew genocide. And then suddenly they get destroyed by this owl, and the perspective shifts to the owl. And then later on, I mean, I really can't go on because there's just so much of it. But it's as brutal as Watership Down, but explicitly a children's book. I thought particularly, and of course, like a lot of the, you know, reading this as a child, some of the humour I got, some of the things like, you know, the dolls being speaking in newspaper and the elephant being pretentious and like sort of, you know, house proud, are things that did register with me as a child. But on page 62, there's a bit where a theatrical troupe called the Caws of Art, spelt C-A-W-S,
Caws like a bird,
hence, you know, Caws. Like a bird. Would you like to explain that niche reference?
No, I have to make a reference to This Morning of Richard Not Judy every episode, so it's fine. Listeners should be on board of it by now.
Oh, they're already.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, the Caws of Art, as in crows cawing of art, are a theatrical troupe who perform what appears to be a parody of Samuel Beckett.
Well, you didn't get then, the extended parody of Endgame as a child, Stu. Come on.
No, I didn't at all, obviously. Which turns out to have been written by another character in the book, which is the turtle, I think, or the tortoise at the bottom. Is it a turtle? Yeah, I think it's a turtle at the bottom of the pond.
Yeah, snapping turtle.
But most of their troop are... there's a riot. There's more violence. One of their performers, the rabbit, is killed. I'm pretty sure that quite a few of the rest of them are killed. It ends with a sentence, the rest of the audience abandon themselves to the general riot and thereby purge themselves of all remaining pity and terror. A reference to Aristotelian catharsis. And of course, no, none of this you get as a child, obviously.
Comes across is even more inexplicable. Well, it comes across completely inexplicable in the film. I think the film is quite faithful to the book, but in a way that makes it like just quite bewildering on a number of levels, because you don't get any of the context. It's just a big platter of oddness. So I watched the film first and I was like, well, that was very strange. Then I read the book and I was like, okay, now I'm starting to understand what's happening. And then watched the film again and it made a lot more sense. But just the film on its own is just a very strange experience, I found.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the comments on YouTube referred to the play and the can, the tin of dog food that inspires the play. So the play is called The Last Visible Dog. And Ren, do you want to sort of explain what The Last Visible Dog is?
Yes.
So there's a can of, is it Bonzo's?
The can of Bonzo dog food, and it has, I'm sure I wrote down a page number for the description of the Bonzo dog food. Page 92, okay. I'll read the description of the dog food. Bonzo dog food, said the white letters on the orange label. And below the name was a picture of a little black and white spotted dog wearing a chef's cap and apron. The dog was walking on his hind legs and carrying a tray on which there was another can of Bonzo dog food, on the label of which another little black and white spotted dog, exactly the same but much smaller, was walking on his hind legs and carrying a tray on which there was another can of Bonzo dog food, and so on until the dogs became too small for the eye to follow. Very much like the slush puppy logo, actually, used to in the 90s, the slush puppy cups had another slush puppy cup on them, and I remember sitting in a cafe and looking at the slush puppies on the slush puppy cup and trying to see the last visible slush puppy. So it's very relatable to me, but
you didn't write an existential Samuel Beckett-like play.
No, I didn't.
The Last Visible Slush
Puppy. I didn't, no.
But obviously that's sort of like part of the philosophy sort of exploration as a child was effective and did strike me as something being, you know, a thought-provoking sort of meditation on infinity and recursion and stuff. But obviously... the things like the cause of art scene is supposed to be humorous, right? There's lots of bits of it that are, well, they are humorous. I think they are quite funny. But the things with the cause of art theme in particular, the idea is that they're performing this philosophical play based on The Last Living Dog that is a sort of Beckett parody. And the idea is that they're performing it in front of the sort of ingrate, rough and ready groundling animals who just turn it into a literal riot, which is quite a funny like idea. But to me as a child, it's just horrific and motiveless, very sudden violence. because I didn't know get any of these jokes. So.
Well, I think there's an autobiographical element to it as well. Because reading Russell Hoban's Wikipedia entry, said his father was the director of the Drama Guild of the Labour Institute of the Workmen's Circle of Philadelphia.
Right. I'm sure they were a rough crowd, but I don't know if they ever actually murdered the performers.
I don't know how the Labour Institute of the Workmen's Circle of Philadelphia responded to Samuel Beckett, but I did wonder if this was the young Russell Hobad seeing his dad put on Endgame in Philadelphia, and maybe that's how the crowd responded. I
did find his background quite interesting, because I another thing I assumed as a child was that this was British. Like, it's got a very British sensibility to it, and he...
Yeah, because it has that kind of... That's why I said it reminded me almost of Victorian literature. Like, obviously there's Alice in Wonderland aspects, like just the kind of sense of whimsy and dread, but also these little philosophical thought experiments that are peppered throughout it, which is very much like Alice in Wonderland. But also even Water Babies, weirdly. And Water Babies obviously has this sort of finger-wagging Christianity to it, whereas this is much more existentialist. But again, like this sort of... these characters who are quite vulnerable and lost at sea and... pathetical, pathetic in a kind of pitiful, kind of heartstring tugging way, being put out into the world and having to encounter these different strange characters. Like, that just seems like a really kind of English Victorian kids' literature thing.
But he did emigrate to England. Okay. So, and of course, Ridley Walker is set in Kent, I believe, post-apocalyptic Kent. But like, yeah. So he did. I think it is somewhere halfway between an American and a British sensibility. Although it is actually set in America, which I didn't realize as a child. But when you actually like look at things like the fauna, like chipmunks and things like that, it's clearly it must be America.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I took George to see a film called Hundreds of Beavers a few weeks ago. Have you seen it, Stu?
No.
It's thoroughly recommended. So it's sort of set in... It's done in the style of you're not going to believe this film exists. So it's done in the style of a 1910s photo play. Okay, like a silent film. It's set in Canada.
I mean, it sounds like something you might find that you didn't want to after a Google search, frankly.
But no. And it's about an Applejack salesman who gets drunk on his own cider and ends up lost in the woods. And to marry the love of his life, this woman, her father will only let him marry her if he brings him hundreds of beaver pelts. And from there on in the style of a 1910s photo play, silent film, and it's basically a silent film, it goes into an adventure game / platformer style where you've got a kill count for the beavers in the top right corner of the screen. And he's got to create Wile E. Coyote style traps from the objects around him to kill the beavers, who are just people walking around in beaver costumes.
Okay, I think it sounds brilliant.
Until he's killed hundreds of beavers. It's very good.
I'm not entirely sure what it's to do with Basil and his child, but...
Because having watched that during the whole scene with the beavers and the beaver dam, I kept picturing it as this damn film, basically. It was quite distracting. basically they come across this muskrat. They're told the frog... We've mentioned the frog, and the frog kind of starts off as a kind of a con frog, and who pretends to be a fortune teller, but actually seems to be just putting it on, but seemingly has some kind of revelation or some kind of. I don't know if it's spiritual, but
they do this sort of like Professor Trelawney thing, where this person is a total fraud most of the time, but has like this one true prophecy, which seems to concern the mouse's child. Not to interrupt your getting to the muskrat bit, but I am very interested in what you thought the philosophy or the theology of the film or the book was, because I think that's very unclear as well, or very at least thought provoking, at least, you know. Maybe a bit in the eye of the beholder.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I mean, that's why it sort of reminded me of like some kind of medieval allegory or morality play, but with a sort of strange existentialist, like...
Right, it's almost Christian, isn't it? Because, but not in a very explicit way, more in the sort of like, here's your eternal, you know, here's the suffering you have to go through on Earth in order to get into heaven. That's one reading of it.
The characters they meet, obviously, in the different sort of scenes or tableau they pass through, I guess I'm reminded of a medieval allegory, right, because of the way that they seem to stand in for the vagaries of human experience, right, all the different kind of modalities of human experience. So you've got the war with a capital W, with the shrew. Fighting, and then you have the cause of art, so you have art as well, and then you have philosophy. So they seem to kind of move through these different increasingly rarefied modes of experience or being in the world before they kind of reach the happy ending. But so on some level it feels like, yeah, some kind of Christian allegory, but it also does feel like quite absurdist and like almost like Samuel Beckett, like just one damn thing after another. Like there's that line in one of Beckett's later, I can't remember which one it is, one of his novels, I think, the I must go on, I'll go on. I can't go on, I'll go on.
Hmm.
Like, it seems like a lot of it's about like the kind of futility of moving forwards or the impossibility of moving forwards, but then they still move forwards.
Yeah. I thought there was like almost like a Buddhist kind of resonance with like the contemplating infinity through the medium of the last visible dog, and then kind of the mouse child eventually realizing like there's nothing on the other side of nothing but us. Like there's nothing beyond the last visible dog but us, and kind of achieving this.
And almost on a natural level, they go through multiple lives, right? Because they keep on getting sort of destroyed and put back together again. They go through these sort of stages illustrating different parts of the experience that Adam was alluding to. So, yeah, you could also read it as a Buddhist allegory, really.
I could see as a child, it must have felt really kind of weird and profound without always being able to make any sense of it.
I still don't think I could really make any sense of it as an adult, because, like, as I say, for a long period of reading it, because I kind of forgotten what happens in the end and everything like that, but, like, I think this is almost nihilistic. But then it has a happy ending, and it seems to have, like, true prophecy in it in a way that seems almost religious in some way or spiritual in some way. It's very hard to pin down, like, kind of, or put into a box what its grand philosophy of the world is, or what Russell Hoban's views on the world are. Like,
I think the thing that I sort of came away with from the book in particular is this kind of the kind of quiet sort of dignity and perseverance of the wind-ups as they in their suffering, and you know, and then eventually reaching this this happy ending, which is, you know, really, it's quite like a thorough happy ending, like that it feels earned, I think.
And Adi, even so, unlike in the film, right? Even Manny Rat is redeemed.
Sort of. Is he though?
Oh wow!
he was redeemed, then he lapses, and then he's sort of redeemed again, I think.
That bit at the ending, which obviously for the benefit of the listeners, just to summarise, but they eventually sort of find their way back to the doll's house, which has been abandoned. They manage to use their allies, their friends they've met along the way, in order to sort of fight a war against the rats who've taken it over in a sort of and are using it as some kind of sort of bawdy house or something like that. It's kind of like it's a bit like the end of The Wind in the Willows, where they take back Toad Hall of thing. But they use all their allies to take this back. They repair the house and everything like that, and all of the many of the clockworks get to live there happily. And Manny Rat gets to live there happily, even though he's the antagonist and he's the person they're fighting against. He gets all of his teeth knocked out again in another sort of quite horrific sort of little incident. But he's this sort of broken rat, but appears to be completely harmless, so they sort of allow him in. And they, you know, even the mouse child with his sort of infinite trust and goodness, like, refers to him as Uncle Manny, because he refers to all of these male friends as uncles. And Manny appears to be redeemed for a little while, but then Manny starts getting his old, you know, thirst for vengeance against these clockworks who've bettered him back. And he comes up with this horrible plot to blow them all up, because he's a talented sort of fixer and electrician. So he sort of rigs a whole house to blow when they connect the fairy lights. But due to complete random chance, this plan is foiled. Like something sort of, you know, moves the gunpowder out of the way or something like that. I can't remember exactly what. And the plan doesn't come to fruition, or it only, like, oh yes, it's sort of, it only electrocutes him. He thinks he's going to, you know, this live wire is going to destroy the whole house by blowing up the gunpowder, but it actually electrocutes him. And then he comes to consciousness, and at that point he appears to be eventually redeemed and gives up this vengeance and sort of takes it as a sign that he was not meant to get the vengeance, and that he's meant to be living in harmony with them. But because it's Manny Rat, you're never quite sure. just one thing, yeah. Just biographically, Russell Hoban had an unfinished sequel called The Adventures of Manny Rat.
Yeah.
So, or The Return of Manny Rat. I think it's called The Return of Manny Rat.
Return of Manny Rat.
Which I've not read, you know, maybe he's back up to his old tricks. Who knows?
No, I don't think so. I think it's Return of the Good and good and kind-hearted Manny Rat. And Manny Rat returns to spread joy and benevolence.
Okay, I won't ruin it for you. I'll let you believe that.
But yeah, you can get hold of it, though. There's a publication of sort of collected some of Russell Hoban's novels, like some of his novels for adults, I think. And along with this collection is The Return of Manny Rat in its unfinished state. So I am quite intrigued.
Yeah, and they decide to make the house a hotel at the end, call it The Last Visible Dog. And they have a sign, and underneath it says The Last Visible Dog, and it has the picture of the dog, and then underneath it says Migrants, Yes. which is just really lovely. I just thought that was great. And so, yeah, they welcome in all the migrating birds, and it becomes a music venue and a theatre where the play The Last Visible Dog is finally performed in full, and the snapping turtle comes out of the pond to see it performed, and it's quite a lovely ending.
And I believe the cause of art get through it in full without any members of their company being eaten or being brutally murdered.
Yeah. but all of that's quite truncated in the film. Don't get any of the Manny Rat redemption stuff.
Which kind of makes more sense as a narrative arc, right? It's a bit of an unwieldy. It's not a classic structure, right? But I also like that it leaves that ambiguity of, you know, not knowing if Manny's been fully redeemed.
Yeah, yeah.
I think.
I mean, yeah.
Right. Yes, they carry on.
Oh no, you go right.
I was going to say something. Okay, I think we'd be remiss to talk about the film without talking about the donkey. I just feel like it's important we get the donkey in there.
Okay, so this is quite an early scene.
Yeah.
Of proper children's horror, actually. So you were already talking about the horror of the clockwork animals being disassembled while still conscious, and this is done pretty upsetting ends early on in the film, where Manny Rat, so Manny Rat has a sort of band of enslaved clockwork toys who he forces to scavenge for him.
And we mentioned Coraline earlier, but there's this very Coraline echo where the mouse child sees this band of wind-ups and says, "Papa, are they wind-ups like us?" And the father says, "Not anymore." which is also what's said about the other father in the Coraline, the film, when he's turning back into a gourd. the donkey, this is in the book as well, but it's more memorable in the film. The donkey's like, I just can't do it anymore, you know, he's falling to bits. And Manny Rat says, "Ralphie, my boy, he's spare parts, unhinge him." We see the sort of shadows on the wall of the donkey being taken apart. And the mouse child says, "That was horrible." yeah, it was. I feel like I've seen that clip in some kind of compilation of like children's horror sort of things.
The only other thing I wanted to mention from the film is we sort of mentioned briefly the muskrat, and the muskrat is sort of what was this sort of working class muskrat, but has become sort of elevated himself, or possibly has just become quite pretentious and irritating, and has become this sort of philosopher. So used to repair clockwork toys, but says he's above this now and works in the pure realm of abstraction and ideas, but kind of resents the beavers who he sees as beneath him, but who are able to do rather more and get stuff done. So the muskrat basically sort of says that he'll help out the mouse and his child and help them become self-winding, but only if they help him on this problem he's got, which turns out to be the problem of cutting down trees in order to beat the beavers at their own game. And there's a song that the muskrat sings, I guess, or is sung about the muskrat, which, like, the music is like this Baroque harpsichord music. And then you have like this operatic voice singing like bizarre logic philosophy nonsense.
Yep. Yeah.
Like, I'm going to just have to play a clip.
It's quite an experience.
It's hard to get across how weird it is.
Yeah.
I've
got to
watch the film.
Yeah. It's only 84 minutes, which...
It's pretty condensed, as Ren said. It doesn't make much sense.
It sounds less coherent than the book in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty incoherent. but I can definitely see if you caught it like on TV as a kid, like it would probably stay with... It'd be one of those things where you would think for years later, "Well, that can't have been real. I must have dreamt of that, or I must be misremembering that." Because, the experience of watching it, especially, I watched it after reading a fair bit of the book, but definitely, like you said, Ren, trying to watch it without having read it, like, I don't think it makes much sense.
Because it's so, like, there's a lot of the parody and the kind of play with words in the book, and the film is also quite wordy, but just devoid of context. It's quite bizarre.
Like there's a lot of puns, right? And sort of these quite schizophrenic word associations at times.
Mm.
And just playing on words. And yeah, like in context, you can make some sense of it and it's funny. But like out of context, when this is just dialogue, characters are saying,
yeah,
like it's really confusing.
Well, there's this whole thing with, but you mentioned Muskrat, like you know, this is in the book where I assume this makes it to the film, where he has this way of talking where, yeah, this sort of cod philosophy thing where he will phrase things as equations. Things like dog minus how equals y and things like that, right? As if this is some sort of formal logic, which is a funny joke and kind of makes more sense in the book. Although, again, I guess it's something that probably confused me a lot as a child. But if somebody's just, if the character in an animated film is just spouting that, and I don't know if he just spouts that, it's
He doesn't just spout that, he sings it. Like, this is the stuff that becomes a song. So it's like, you know, it is literally like...
Dog times Y equals how?
Yeah.
And again, just to emphasise, this was marketed as a children's book. It's not a case like Warship Down or something, where it's like often mistaken for a children's book, but I don't think it was published as one. It was marketed as a children's book. I've got written down just a little list of words. Chafing dishes, velveteen, cornices, guidons, gnomons, catonic, cotopin, accretion, demiurge, warp and woof. I think this is kind of one of those things where, I mean, thank God for the 60s, because I don't think that you would get away with publishing this as a children's book now. An editor would make you take all of these words out and probably like try and make you simplify the philosophy and... It's a weird categorizer. It's a little...
Do we need the Beckett parody?
Yeah, exactly.
In this children's novel?
Can we cut the full 20 pages of Beckett parody from this? No, we cannot. It's a sentence. What about this bit where they're stuck motionless at the bottom of the pond for 6 months, just contemplating infinity? Nope, that's staying in. You know.
Yeah, and like it really slows down at that point, like you really have to sit with them stuck at the bottom of the pond. Like, it's, although it made me think a bit of Pinocchio. I don't know if that's because of the kind of, I did think of Pinocchio at times in the Disney version. Maybe because of like aspects.
Yeah, it's got a sort of...
I don't know, like the...
It fits in that sort of, like, place of, like, stories about created people, you know? So there's, like, you know, Pinocchio. It reminded me a lot of AI. Obviously, that's, like, you know, the film, the Kubrick-Spielberg film. But that's later, and that's almost like a retelling of Pinocchio. But, like, this sort of... Yeah, it's very much, like, fits into that tradition of... And you see it in like earlier fairy tales and Pinocchio and things like that as well, of like, you know, this homunculi, this created thing coming to life, and this sort of horror of, well, we've said it before, you know, where is the consciousness?
Yeah.
What's the moment of consciousness? It's very interesting at the start, because it's very unclear as to when the moment of consciousness is, whether it's the toy being taken out of the box or being wound, or what's the spark of life. Like, it's, and to me, yeah, there is something like existentially horrific about that. To try and get back on top
and
of
it. And it doesn't. And what's interesting as well is, like, for all that there's toys, we don't get any, I don't think.
Children.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Like, well, yeah, we don't really get any children. We don't get any, like, happy playing with the toys.
The closest person, like, is the tramp.
We get accounts
of
how.
Probably the closest.
Otherwise, right? All you get is how the toys are disregarded, are bust up, are damaged, are thrown away.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of like, it's almost like the opposite kind of, the opposite view that Toy Story has. Obviously, in Toy Story, it's all about, you know, the toys can only kind of be self-actualized when they're somebody's toy, right? And the whole purpose of being a toy is to be loved by children. And that's what kind of almost, you know, that imbues them with life. Whereas here it's kind of like the worst possible thing almost is for a toy to be sold to a kid, because they're probably just gonna, like, you know, leave it outside to get rained on, or throw it down the stairs, or sit on it or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get through the bit where the toys are abandoned really quickly at the start of the book. So they're in the lovely high toy shop to begin with. They get sold. We never hear about any children by name, or even, I think there are children in the household where they are, but they're Christmas ornaments, right? They're taken out every Christmas. The children are told not to play with them. They're delicate or whatever. They get put back in the box, and they get, you know, this is, I guess, quite horrific in itself, but like they get, you know, for 6 years or something like that, they have a long period, which is dealt with in a matter of a few pages, where they're only ever getting their moment in the sun for a couple of weeks a year, and then they're getting locked away back in the attic, and eventually they then get thrown out in the garbage by adults. There's no children's love redeeming them in this.
No,
they only have themselves. You know, again, it's kind of humorous. Yeah, I think that's where I landed with it. That it's almost like, you know, the love of the child and the father, and their love for the elephant who the child wants to be his mother, you know, and their love for all of their uncles who are this sort of motley crew of dodgy frogs and you know, people who wanted to eat them but was afraid not to and stuff like that. You know, that I think that for me, ultimately, yeah, that message is kind of a message of self-sufficiency, and that, you know, this is all there is, and we may as well be kind to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a kind of hard-won humanism, although not humanism, toyism or toyism. Whatever. Or kind of stoicism, I suppose. Like you said, Ren, there's a lot about them kind of being dignified in their suffering.
Yeah, and like right at the end, it says the mouse and his child, who had learned so much and had prevailed against such overwhelming odds, never could be persuaded to teach a success course. Popular demand was intense, but they steadfastly refused. The whole secret of the thing, they insisted, was simply and at all costs to move steadily ahead. And that, they said, could not be taught. Yeah.
So no easy answers, kids. You just gotta suffer.
Do you think that's what's in the Return of Manny Rat? Do you think he becomes like an influencer with like a multi-level marketing scheme? Manny's protein shakes or something.
Yeah.
Oh. It turns out they're just rat milk. He's selling rat milk to.
But yeah, thank you for suggesting it, Stu, because I don't know if it's one we would have come across otherwise. And yeah, it's a really interesting, really strange book.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I think it, I feel like it should be more well known. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'd never heard of it, at least.
Yeah, maybe in, you have to email us, American listeners, like if you'd heard of this before, because I don't know if this is like better known, if this is like a children's classic in America and it's just not one that's as well known in the UK, maybe.
I think it's probably just too dark in the final telling, you know, for it to be mainstream, basically.
I wonder if Robin Jarvis read this and was like, right, hold my beer, like, because it's like depth and mice goes further.
But what if after they died, the enemies wore their skins? Is that
perhaps even worse?
Yeah.
I did want to like read one quote, which was not from the book, but rather from this is on a sort of like a Guardian article about it, about somebody saying it's their favourite book, and I didn't read it as a child, basically. Oh, cool. But the top comment was, people are always trying to tell me what a great book The Road is, and I always want to tell them that The Road is just the really boring version of The Mouse and His Child.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Which I do like The Road.
But I think, did we see The Road together?
We did see The Road, and we like laughed for a full 5 minutes at the Coca-Cola product placement.
What?
Oh, yeah.
I forgot that.
Yeah.
I mean, is it as good as the Coca-Cola product placement in the Drifting Classroom? I wonder how many post-apocalyptic films have included Coca-Cola product placement.
Look, you know, everybody's got to make their way in the world, and you know, even Russell Hoban, he's taking bungs from the Bonzo Dog Food Corporation.
That's true. Okay, well, let's wrap it up.
All right. I just wanted to shout out Alex on Twitter, who said after listening to our recent Goosebumps episode, "Justice for Kruger and the Puppet Carnival."
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Agree.
Yeah, hard agree. I'll give updates. You know, I'm back to school in just over a week. So if Kruger resurfaces, I will let everyone know. I hope Kruger hasn't been thrown out in a skip to go on his own mouse's child like odyssey of suffering across Ipswich.
Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music's by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. I have the details in the show notes along with the transcript. Stu, do you want to promote yourself at all to our listeners?
I don't think I've really got anything to promote. I suppose.
Well, will you fail better.
Yeah,
games,
I suppose I should give a.
Your games are really.
This
good.
Is not well. Look, I mean, this is not a work activity, but I probably should give a little bit of a bung to the company I work for, Fail Better Games. We make sort of games all set in this sort of dark Victoriana gothic fantasy universe called Fallen London. The titular Fallen London is a browser game that you can play for free without installing anything. And we also make sort of console and standalone games like Sunless Skies, Sunless Sea, and our latest Mask of the Rose, which is a romance game with a bit of a murder mystery set in the same universe.
Excellent. Thank you.
I think Sunless Sea is my second top played game on Steam. I think possibly third. It was after the Small World board game, which... surprised me because I didn't think I liked it that much, but apparently I do.
A glowing.
But, I think Sunda sees it better. Sunda sees definitely much, much better, and works really well when played to the Silent Hill soundtracks. I'll say. And they've got good sounds.
Yeah, it's got lovely, too, lovely, yeah, lovely soundtrack.
It does. But you know, the Silent Hill musical.
Silent Hill. They're doing a nice. they're doing a sort of remake, full HD remake.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is completely off topic.
No, there is. Okay, let's. But thank you for listening, everyone. And you can sign off.
You could even.
Yeah. Don't. Don't lose hope until you see the last visible dog.
Oh, Yeah. Thank you for coming on, Stu. It's been great to have you and to talk about the mouse and his child. And I'll catch you later, spooky kids.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
Bye.